Good afternoon, everyone. How y'all doing? Good, good, good. Are y'all having a great conference?
Yeah.
Good, good, good. I just want to say, first of all, thank you very much for having me here today. I take this as an honor to stand in front of you all and to share some of my opinions and sort of talk about some of the work that I've done in the community and talk about it from a way that really tries to position us not only within our own communities and with our own knowledge base and with all of our multiple identities, but then also thinking about sort of what relationships and sort of how those relationships with those systems, with those people, with our service providers, with our young people impact our decision making, and particularly young people's sexual decision making. I mean, really talk about LGBTQ issues and the issues that are affecting them in that sort of interdisciplinary, multidimensional, dynamic, complex way. So have about 15 minutes. And so I just want to highlight a few things. And so my intentions for the time that I have with you are to briefly discuss sexuality, explore some of the challenges for LGBTQ youth, some roles, our own roles, and some opportunities for engagement, and some strides for success. And so what I've seen working with different community-based organizations across this country. And to ultimately offer us some suggestions and recommendations for us so how we can continue to do the work better, more engaging, and to really sort of see the impact and the outcomes that we want to see and sort of reverse the tide of negative sexual health outcomes that have impacted all of us in various ways. And so I wanted to start by reading a quick quote. And I thought I would have my paper, so bear with me. Oh, there are my notes. Look at that. So this is by Dr. Judith D. Auerbach, and I don't know if I pronounced her last name right. It says, as a result, the HIV prevention field as a whole has come to recognize that HIV is fundamentally a pathogen that is transmitted in the course of human relationships that occur and are influenced by social and cultural contexts, and that targeting only one aspect of the interacting biological, behavioral, and social features of HIV/AIDS, which I would also add in there STIs, will have limited effect. And sort of what struck me throughout the day and as I was thinking about this is I want to hold this conversation that I'm going to discuss briefly in the context of relationships. Relationships. And as we begin to explore this, that we might become aware of what we're doing and how we're engaging in relationships, how we are making decisions about our relationships, and thinking about the impact that our relationships have on whether someone's going to come and access our services or not. And so that's what I want to have in this this moment that we have together. And so going forward, I just want to point our attention to a few things. That when we're talking about LGBTQ issues, we're really talking about a group of folks who have been marginalized historically, systematically, not innocently left out, but intentionally left out of the conversations, the discourse in this country. And really starting to imagine what does it mean for us to have a population of people not be able to experience themselves in the media in a positive, healthy light, not to be able to experience and live full lives within their families, within their communities, within their churches, and so on. And so what we're talking about is, again, relationships and sort of trying to figure out how do we begin to do that? How do we begin to have authentic relationships in order to stem the tide of HIV infection rates, particularly among LGBT youth of color? And forgive me of going back and forth, GLBTQ, LGBTQ, I'm using it as an overarching term, so bear with me. And so thinking about this missing history, so we need to know a couple of things. We need to know something about sexuality. We need to understand that sexuality refers to not only behaviors, but identities and desires as well. And that we also need to understand that sexuality is fluid for some of us. And some might argue for everyone. And that most likely are influenced by a combination of both social, cultural, and biological factors. So this whole conversation of nature versus nurture is a moot point. It is both and. We cannot exist without the sociocultural as well as the biological in determining our who we are and how we're going to engage with each other. And so, again, the fact that most of us do not get comprehensive sexuality education ever, unless you go to college, is a huge problem. It means that there are groups, large groups of people, particularly communities of color, that do not have the information necessary to be able to engage in their own sexual agency. They won't be able to continue to understand the sort of dynamics and the complexity of their own sexual identities, and therefore begin to buy into a lot of the social stereotypes and myths about sort of how we are to be. And so just thinking about that, and I won't go any more into that, but, you know, you can, you know, I did some work in sexuality studies, and so I spent 2 years studying in this, and it's still a process, and it's still a journey. So I just wanted to highlight those really quickly as well. And then thinking about sort of the complexity in which we start having our own interactions. So we have our microsystem, we have our peers and our family members who are so close to us, and that we're getting our own ideas around what sexuality is from them, from the TV, from the media. And as we begin to get older and sort of engage at different levels with these systems, that's when we get a lot of our messages and continue to sort of redefine ourselves in context of what's happening in the larger social structures. And so I really wanted to highlight some of the challenges to really begin to sort of kind of put it in a way that I think is easier to digest. And sort of, you know, so once people can go and download these slides, they can take them home and look at it like this. And so when we're thinking about some of the challenges, we're thinking about sort of the difficulties with parents and families. We're talking about acceptance. We're talking about relationships. We're talking about abuse. We're talking about relationships. We're talking about not being valued or involved. We're talking about relationships. We're talking about issues in our communities. We're talking about harassment, physical violence, physical abuse viewed as having low expectations or not being empowered at all. We are talking about relationships. And so all of those sort of things, all of those challenges begin to sort of amount to sort of how we feel about ourselves. And sort of what that has on our self-esteem and our own decision-making sexually, and sort of as a whole individual as well. We start seeing, you know, depression and isolation, and then we also start seeing those really negative sexual health outcomes. And then we start seeing the risky behaviors and the alcohol abuse in the lens of relationships. When we don't have the support necessary to begin to engage not only with ourselves authentically, but with our communities, with our families, with our friends, we start seeing negative sexual health outcomes, as well as a number of different, what folks have talked about in terms of today, and syndemics and sort of depression and other areas of our lives having, feeling like they're out of control. And so I can't sort of downplay sort of this influence of culture. And these notions of what it means to be a man or woman and to do these gender roles and do this performativity stuff. And then also thinking particularly about sort of how we are racialized or sexualized based on our race. And to really try to figure out how those differences and how we begin to talk about racialized sexual identities in the larger context of a history of oppression and colonization in this country impacts our communities at whole. And so until we begin to start dealing with these real root cause issues that I am bringing up in terms of racism, homophobia, sexism, ableism, classism, we really will not be able to see the type of outcomes, those positive sexual health outcomes that we need. And so when I'm thinking about social determinants of health, what I'm talking about, what I'm hearing are root cause issues, racism, classism, ableism. And so when I'm thinking about sort of these issues, it's really coming from that lens. Also thinking about the role of spirituality and religion has on our own sexual decision making. What's interesting about sexuality is not all of those things, it's not just the behavior. And it's not only what people are telling us, it's also those things that they're not telling us. And so even in this context of understanding our religion roles, religion and their roles in, that they're playing in our own sexual identity, it's not that they're always telling us things are bad, 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 don't do this, don't do that. It's the fact that they're omitting a lot of different information. They're omitting a history of people, which has a negative impact on us and our own identity and understanding of who we are. I'm thinking about the economic realities and sort of thinking about sort of the lack of resources, how money is used in this country and how it determines access. And if you don't have it, some of us would say that you don't deserve access to healthcare if you can't afford to pay for it yourselves. And particularly when we start looking at sort of how the disparities and how LGBTQ folks are, and particularly those of color, are having their income, you know, not being able to get a job because you're trans. This has a huge impact on our decision making and what we have to do to survive. And that everybody who's not engaging with systems to be employed don't do it just because they don't want to work. They're doing it because sometimes they don't have the option to, because people are systematically pushing them and forcing them out of those situations. And that goes for all people who are sort of having these multiple identities that have been historically marginalized within our society. And then also this notion of sort of providers coming from the outside into our communities thinking that, you know, they know best what's for us. And sort of one of the main flaws with this is that what we've seen is that, yes, you might have what we might need, but that might not be what our community has as a priority at that moment. And so irrespective of all of the amazing work that people are doing, nothing will happen until our hierarchy of needs are met. And the relationships, the partnering with our community to say, okay, let's figure out what works best for you to sort of see the outcomes that we want, that is something that does not happen often. That collaboration, that level of authentic sharing is not something that is common, and I would urge us to really consider how we might begin to partner and have relationship with one another that is not one-sided, that it's dynamic and it is developed and maintained and created in partnership and collaboration, in relationship with one another. And so when I was thinking about this presentation, and there were just some tough questions that I was wrestling with. So what role do we play in perpetuating some of or all of the challenges that GLBTQ youth face, whether it's intentionally or unintentionally? What are we doing or what are we not doing to start changing the culture in which has us certain populations be sort of valued and understood here, and then having some organization or some people valued and understood here? Right? And so how are we maintaining this power, this hierarchy, and sort of what is the impact of that on LGBT youth of color? And sort of what is our role or some of the critical questions that we sort of have to start asking ourselves? And so what is the real impact of not knowing? Right? So what is the tangible, the lived experience of us not knowing what happens in us during our sort of journey to our own sexual identity? That does not allow us to be able to then be in jobs and to create programs that are culturally specific and important and culturally appropriate. We shouldn't be having the conversation around cultural appropriateness. It should just be happening. The fact that we have to keep going back and saying cultural competency, have these workshops, do this and do this, that means that something is not happening here with us, inside of us, that does not allow us to engage across difference, across sexuality, across gender, across race in an authentic way, that we have to keep having these conversations and going back. And until we start engaging and spending some time trying to evaluate and sort of spending some time trying to engage and talk about the process of engaging with service providers and sort of what they need to understand, to learn in the most optimal way, we're not going to see the outcomes that we're going to need to see and to meet the vision of the 2012. And I think that's super important for us to be considering. And I also wanted to put out there that some of us have heard the knowledge. Today, I've been to workshops that have been amazing. I have seen people talk about research that has phenomenal implications for generations to come. And yet, where rubber meets the road, we don't get anywhere with that information. And so I have to begin to question, so what is happening? What is not allowing us to engage and to remove research to practice? What is not happening in our own institutions that does not allow us the tools, the time to engage and learn of strategies to engage the communities? How do we begin to translate information so that it's understandable? So I have to begin to talk about sort of my grandmother. How do I begin to talk to my grandmother about sexual identity in a way that she can understand it? Because I can come to her talking about Freud, and I can come talking to her about Judith Butler and discourse and all of these other things, but you know what? She'll look at me like I'm crazy. Because what I'm talking to her makes no sense because it doesn't have a context. And so when we're thinking about developing messages and working with folks, that's something that we have to factor in. The communities in which we're working, we have to be at their level. We are privileged folks in this room. We are privileged folks. And we expect for people to meet us where we are, to be able to accept all of the goods that we can offer them so that they can better themselves. In reality, what we need to be is where they are. working with them, developing interventions with them. That's why I'm a huge fan of community-based participatory research. Because that is a way of engaging the community so that our information that we're creating has the ability to begin to push us forward as a movement, as a people, and help us grow in our humanity. And so what I really wanted to talk about in the few minutes that I do have left is also to begin to highlight sort of what I have seen happen when people get in real relationship with each other, in partnership. And so as a working for a national organization, I get to travel to different community-based organizations across the country and spend time with their staff, analyzing their services, talking with their staff people, really trying to get a sense of who they are, and then developing instruments, tools that they might be able to use to engage my target population. And I usually work with GLBT youth of color, and sometimes even more specifically Black MSM, and really trying to really talk about quickly what I've seen people be able to do that other people in this country can't even seem to begin to fathom. That is creating an ASO in Virginia that I work with, or the Baltimore City Health Department, have been able to reach hundreds in one night, young Black MSM, young LGBT youth of color, to offer testing, to offer referrals and linkages to care. And it was through partnership and collaboration with key stakeholders in the ballroom community. If you're not aware what the ballroom community is, look up Paris is Burning, and you'll get an introduction into what the ballroom scene is. And so what they've been able to do at these places were to create safe spaces. And so I can't downplay the importance of literally creating a physical space that so that folks can come and engage that is away from the bar. Not all of our activities have to be centered around the bar. And so when we don't have spaces, that is where we tend to gravitate to, because that's where our community is. And so until we start creating places for our community to gather, we won't be able to sort of create the environment to model what type of environment folks should be existing and living in. And so what those organizations have also done was to be able to create and consider social and cultural factors that influence behavior, that they involved community members, but they involved LGBTQ youth. They involved young Black, queer, trans-identified folks in the decision-making and the planning. And they provided those young people with the tools, the leadership tools, because when I'm talking about sort of trying to, what it takes to sort of begin to change behavior, it is not one intervention. It is a holistic intervention that talks and speaks to the whole person. And so if those folks who were in the Advancing the Sexual Health seminar today, or symposium, that there was a definition laid out that was totally encompassing. Mental, spiritual, physical, emotional, those sexual pieces as well, right? That's the totality. And those types of programs that engage the total person are the ones that will see the outcomes. And that those organizations help build the skills of those young people by engaging in youth development strategies. The connection that I was talking about. One of the biggest things is when you're an LGBTQ person is the fear of loss and those loss of connections and relationships just based on who you are. And so when we begin to even think about what we need to do is that we need to start figuring out how do we strengthen collaborations and connections so that those folks who have historically not had them are able to now have access to them, and we will begin to see the changes that we want to see. And so in conclusion, thinking about sort of some of the strides and successes, so those are some of the things that they did. But ultimately what those, an ASO in Virginia and the Baltimore City Health Department was able to do was to go and co-create something that was meaningful to the target population. And it was in that co-creation that they were able to bring 1,100, 1,200 on one single evening, LGBTQ youth of color, together to do HIV testing while in a drug-free, alcohol-free zone. And I think that's an achievement, because not everyone will do that. Not every health department will partner with those LGBTQ folks, because it doesn't look like what we're used to partner partnering with. It doesn't feel like those who we're used to partnering with. And so I wanted to sort of leave us with that. And just quickly, I have a few more things that I just want to just leave us with. Don't have much time. And so when I was thinking about sort of what it was going to take to change behavior and understanding that there's shared meaning making in our own communities, that our interventions need to start coming with and leading with those sort of historic things that have proven to work in changing culture. And so when I'm thinking about the different movements that we've had in this country, that the time that is spent and invested in meeting with, talking with community stakeholders, mobilizing those who seem that they don't want any part of this, is what will ultimately begin to stem the tide of HIV infection and STI infection. And if we also want to see a reduction in the outcomes among LGBTQ folks and redress some of those disparities, then we must also address the systems of oppression that keep those outcomes in place. Again, and I don't think it's a mistake, and it is not innocent. There are people actively in our communities, across this country, in our government, that is systematically setting us up for failure, for short lives, for negative sexual health outcomes, and to ultimately not even be a part and participate fully in our own society. And that when we really want to talk about the social determinants of health, we're really deconstructing it to a place of that we can see what is really driving and holding people in privilege here and then other folks who are not privileged here. And that that will be in our relationship and how we begin to navigate and change this dynamic, that's where our results will be. And that I started with a quote around relationship. And I think ultimately what I've seen work best, being a person of the community, being on the service end, being also a provider, was that when you've had caring and loving and compassionate folks by your side, what a world of difference it makes. Thank you.